Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Tomorrow is Super Tuesday, and Joe Biden and Donald Trump, at least on the surface, appear completely in control of their respective parties. Of course, underneath, there's this churn of, let's say, unresolved conflicts, emerging issues, and rivals waiting for an opportunity. Casey Hunt is here with me. She's the new host of CNN This Morning from 5 to 7 a.m. Casey, first of all, congratulations on
Thank
the new
you.
Time slot.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome to the assignment.
I'm so happy to be here.
So, Casey, as we are hopping into the studio, the Supreme Court handed out a unanimous decision, actually, that would keep Donald Trump on the Colorado ballot ahead of Super Tuesday. And this basically rejected the Colorado Supreme Court's decision to remove Trump from the ballot on 14th Amendment insurrection grounds. And you and I both watched and covered those oral arguments, and they never seemed all that interested in getting into the insurrection part of it.
Right. They just kind of left the actual question at the heart of the matter aside and focused instead on, you know, ancillary issues that would allow them to decide this kind of the way that they did.
Or argue, I mean, basically they've said, look, states can't make this decision.
Which, okay, you know, not unfair if there's a place for the Supreme Court to be in terms of our political system. It is very squarely supposed to be deciding what is in the hands of the federal government and what's in the hands of the state government. When you heard the justices, even, you know, the most liberal ones on the bench didn't seem willing to entertain this.
Yeah. What this means, though, is all of your ballots out there are pretty much going to stay what they are.
Right.
Which brings us back to the conversation about this election.
It's not a 4-year-old ballot, guys. It is actually a new ballot.
It is.
It just looks the same as it did 4 years ago.
It's a new ballot. And even those who have other options, let's say in Washington, D.C., where Nikki Haley won the Republican primary here, which is like winning the cable news green room vote. who is that voter, right?
That is an interesting way to put it. I mean, if you look at those numbers, I'm not sure where, you know, that happened overnight last night. When I was looking at it this morning on the show, it was about 1,000-some-odd people had voted for Nikki Haley over Donald Trump, and that let her win the D.C. primary. There's not a lot of Republicans in the District of Columbia to begin with.
I stand by my original statement.
Yeah, but she can now say she's the first woman to win a Republican primary in a presidential race.
You know, in South Carolina, about 300,000 people actually came out for her, and that's some 40% of the vote, which she insists is not a tiny group.
I think that's fair, actually. I don't think it is a tiny
group. Yeah, talk more about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think in a state like South Carolina, now we have to understand, of course, she's the home state governor, so in many ways losing it all is embarrassing if you're in that position. She campaigned hard there. She spent a lot of money on the air. But also, it's a pretty conservative state with a very pro-Trump electorate. It's always been a place, you know, I've covered Trump events down in South Carolina, and, you know, many of them across the country are like rock concerts, right? But in South Carolina, there does seem to be a particular affinity for him. It was one of the first places where you could really see it in the Republican electorate.
So this is a primary vote we're talking about.
Right.
And does it reflect support for Nikki Haley or problem for Trump?
I think it reflects a problem for Trump that an electorate in a southern conservative state has that significant of a chunk of the party say, we want somebody else. Now, Nikki Haley, I think, finally found her voice kind of coming out of New Hampshire in terms of saying this is why Donald Trump would be bad for the country. She lumps him together with Joe Biden as well. But we didn't hear that from her until people really had already started voting. It took her a minute to figure that voice out. And I do think you saw
or to think it had any support
to that. Right. Sure. I mean, it was the first time we actually had, you know, a test of voters. But she started moving in the polls before voters went to the polls in Iowa. She had standout debate performances. But in those debate performances, if you go back and look at them, she was not attacking Trump on those stages the way she ultimately ended up and currently to this day is now attacking him.
To the point where her concession speech in South Carolina, I think it was Ari Fleischer who said, That was a no-labels speech by Nikki Haley, referring to this group that's hovering around in the background claiming that it wants to promote a third-party candidate and has not done so yet.
Right. They have not. And Nikki Haley has ruled it out herself. But you're right. I mean, it sounded like a third-party speech because the reality is there is more demand in the country in this election for someone other than one of the two major party likely nominees than there probably has been, certainly that I can remember. Even though third-party candidates have impacted the races that I've covered, they did in 2016, but there wasn't this overwhelming sense that, you know, we want someone else.
I know. The weird part is when you actually look at U.S. history and third-party candidates, they often surge as the result of movements.
Yeah,
there is actually something that they are representing. They're not the option you take because you hate everyone else, right? Nobody steps into that breach of like, whelp. No one wants these dudes. So, I mean, you know, it's like a Ross Perot or whoever. They surge because they have a policy idea or a movement idea or a thing they're standing for. And I have to admit, it just doesn't really look like even of the third party options that is there. Yes, people might say that about Kennedy. Like, there are people who are that into the vaccination issue or whatever he stands for. But I don't see any broad-based movement that is propelling any other voice.
No, the system is not built for that. If anything,
but
honestly,
it's not impossible.
It's not impossible. I think in some ways Trump represents a movement candidate, right? I mean, that's why he's hemorrhaged. The people that are supporting Nikki Haley are the old guard of the Republican Party. There is a vast swath of them that's out there that's been left behind by the movement that is Trump. He just so happens to have taken over one of the two major parties that has a slot on every single ballot across the country, right? And as for Kennedy, you're absolutely right. I don't see the vaccine issue as being something that is so animating to people. But his last name is Kennedy.
But it's been a minute. Maybe I'm saying that because I'm from Massachusetts. Like, does it really carry the
sway? I think it does.
I mean, well, look, name recognition means something, right?
I think
right?
For low-information voters, they're like, I don't like
something.
That guy.
From the movies to your favorite TV shows to, yes, your political candidates, it helps if you've kind of heard the name before. But that doesn't necessarily carry the day.
There are examples of people who's run for local office who have the last name Kennedy who run away with it just because their last name is Kennedy. But there are a lot of, you know, a lot of American voters are low information voters. They don't necessarily engage with these campaigns, certainly the way you or I do. There are going to be those kinds of voters who think Donald Trump, I don't want that guy. Joe Biden, man, that guy's really old. It's kind of what they're telling us in the polls.
Yeah.
Oh, a Kennedy. That sounds great. I think there are also a lot of people who are so I guess these, who knows if these people are actually showing up, but people that are so frustrated with the system that they just want to cast a protest vote, basically. I think there's an element of that.
So that brings us to Michigan, of course. Joe Biden basically.
And that is a high information protest.
Yeah, ran away with it. But of course, 100,000 people did not stay home. They came out to cast ballots after a concerted effort by ceasefire activists to vote uncommitted. So that's 13% of the total vote. And that actually earns the uncommitted group two delegates at the convention, which I didn't really get that, I think, until a day or two later. So what does that mean?
The delegates? What do the delegates mean?
Yeah, like they're
broadly
uncommitted. They're just the ceasefire delegates or they're
Well, they're actually delegates who are allowed to do whatever they want in the balloting, right? So technically, if you want to get into the process, delegates that are committed to a specific candidate when they, in the beginning of the convention anyway, the rules change if the convention itself can't get a nominee. But at the beginning, you go in and you as the delegate, and delegates are people, let's remember.
Exactly.
Each delegate reps the role that they absolutely could play. And I will also say that anytime you have delegates like this, they represent more than just those two people that they are. And this particular issue, I spent a lot of time talking to, my family is originally from Michigan, and I have some close ties to both Republicans and Democrats in the state. And when I talk to them, I mean, this is, they will say, and you can see it in the faces of the people and the way, the anguish in their voices, this is not politics. This is everything to them. You can't underestimate that. And I honestly was surprised by the number of them that actually came up and showed up. I mean, that is a big, big number, more than 100,000 people in a race like this. And I do think it made people stand up and listen.
All right, stay with us. We're talking with Casey Hunt, and we're talking about politics ahead of Super Tuesday.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. quiets their snores, Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number smart beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number smart beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.
Welcome back. My guest is Casey Hunt, and we're talking about politics ahead of Super Tuesday, just trying to get our arms around what we've learned so far and what we're about to learn in the coming weeks. So just before the break, we were talking about the Israel-Hamas war. Mm-hmm. I want to continue on that because now we have had Vice President Kamala Harris come out in front of the Edmund Pettus Bridge, which is in political lore, we won't talk about the civil rights history, in political lore is often used as a backdrop for politicians to say, look, I care about civil rights and in particular the black community. That's how I've always seen it. But she comes out there and she calls for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza and describes the suffering there.
What we are seeing every day in Gaza is devastating. Yes. We have seen reports of families eating leaves or animal feed, women giving birth to malnourished babies with little or no medical care, and children dying from malnutrition and dehydration. As I have said many times, too many innocent Palestinians have been killed.
She's the voice for the administration saying, we hear you. What do you find significant about that moment?
The thing I found most significant was how she put into human terms what we are seeing in a way that it almost feels like others in the administration want to say, oh, don't look at that, don't look at that. We've got this other broader geopolitical concern that we're focused on.
I was shocked they let her do it. Right? So far, they've often deployed her as a person who talks about abortion. Yeah. Or has gone to talk to the people and the voter. And it just felt like they really gave her free rein to speak about this in visceral terms.
I'll be honest with you. I'm interested to know if that's actually how that played out. If the administration said, we want you to go do this. We're okay with you doing this. Because when I heard it, I thought, wow, she's making it harder for President Biden using those terms. And now maybe you're right. Maybe this was, I haven't done the reporting on it to know if this was something that ultimately the West Wing signed off on. But it was really a remarkable moment, I think. And I do think that it speaks a little bit to, I'd want to know what you think about this, but the way in which many black voters are identifying with the cause of people in Gaza. She seems to be, she's obviously the person that the administration has trying to reach out to and energize black voters and to say, we hear you. And when you add that civil rights connection, right, in the American story that the Edmund Pettus Bridge represents and the fact that she was standing there, and it was almost as though she was making an explicit connection, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think one way I've come to think about it is post George Floyd protests, one thing that has not petered off is the connection that young progressive black activists have made with other progressive activists because they are greatly influenced by the political theory known as intersectionality, which is like, I'm not just one thing, there's many things.
Right.
So if you look at Gaza and the war being perpetrated there as one of about oppression, then it's very easy to be attached to it. Right. And to be able to speak out against it. And I think that her being there isn't about black voters. It's about all the voters who now see themselves as part of a broader progressive movement against oppression.
Right.
And the clips of that that will circulate in their social media will be of a number of things all at once, intersectional things, right? A black woman leader at the bridge talking about Gaza. It's all the things. It checks a bunch of boxes.
It is. And I mean, when you mention social media, that makes it a little more plausible to me that perhaps the White House was okay with this, because that is a place where the conversation is happening for younger voters, the images that they are seeing, where that's coming from.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
on their phones, right?
Biden on Seth Meyers, of all things, talking about this with an ice cream cone. Some of this stuff that looks totally incongruous on cable guarantees its memeability and clippability and shareability mm-hmm. online.
Yeah. You know, my question writ large on this, and if to the extent if there is a disconnect between Vice President Harris and President Biden, is the question of support for Israel. And while there's all this intersectionality that you talk about, you know, if you speak with Jewish people, they will say there is a history of oppression there as well. And they will say, don't you remember, you know, what happened to us not that many decades ago?
It speaks to the mix of constituencies that Biden has to consolidate. You have
yes.
to consolidate the voter who's saying, I'm going to make sure we primary everyone who wants a ceasefire. And then you also have to consolidate the 100,000 people in a key state who says, actually, there should be a ceasefire.
Right. And, you know, normally they'll say, well, we're a big tent party. And I mean, that's fine until one part of the tent feels the other part of the tent is literally killing their families. Right. You can't live in the same tent under those circumstances.
I think this speaks to the problem for both candidates going forward, meaning if the former president, Donald Trump, is going to be the nominee of the Republican Party and Joe Biden is going to be the nominee of the Democratic Party, that this is a reality people now have to embrace as they head to the polls on Super Tuesday, all of you out there. That's kind of what you're looking at, unless you take the off-ramp Nikki Haley is offering you by saying that she wants to help us help ourselves by getting out of it, which is her argument.
Mm-hmm.
What is the argument that Trump is making? What is the argument Joe Biden is making to your ear?
President Biden is making the argument that he stabilized a country in the wake of the first Donald Trump administration. I think for Biden, in this context, in this very specific context of being the person that is going to run against Donald Trump, he views it as an existential thing.
But he did the first time.
He did the first time, and that's why he ran the first time. I think that's why he's running again this time. I mean, he has said out loud, if that guy wasn't running, I might not be running. But he is running, so I am running. Right? His message is very much about, honestly, democracy. He sees it in very stark terms, right? Like the future of the United States of America as a functioning democracy.
Okay, and Trump?
And Trump sees this in very personal terms. His advisors have been candid with him, according to reporting, that his best chance of staying out of jail is to become reelected president. He'll talk about revenge. He'll talk about, vindication. It's personal on the one hand. For the people that support him, he is in many ways an embodiment of all of their feelings of being trod upon, right? And there is, I think, something to that we shouldn't overlook. Like, there are a lot of people who feel like they were promised one version of what it would be like to live in America and be able to, you know, successfully have a family, provide for your family, feel like there's a future, right? If you ask people, like, what the American dream means or if they feel like they can achieve it, those numbers are a lot more pessimistic than they were a few decades ago, right? And I think that Trump has successfully tapped into that and has said, you know, the other side, they're out to get you. They don't care about you. They're not going to look out
stupid.
For you.
Right. They think you're...
They look down on you.
They look down on you.
Right. And so I think there's a combination of those two things in what Trump is trying to sell.
So you joked at the top of this that it's like, it's not the ballot from 4 years ago, even though you might think it is. As like an anchor, like, how do you think about covering this thing that can feel like, honestly, deadly repetitive? It feels sometimes like, what can we say that will help people feel like there are new stakes?
Yeah. Well, a couple things. One, January 6th was a very seminal moment for me because I was at the Capitol complex when it was attacked by that mob of rioters. And I saw with my own eyes what happened. And I have watched and covered what has happened in the aftermath, where people have started to question whether or not it did actually happen.
Or like Trump, didn't he bring some January 6th
they now call them January 6th
on
hostages.
Stage and talk mm-hmm. about them as heroes?
Yeah. And, for me, the Capitol I've been a campaign reporter, but then in between stints on the campaign trail, I have covered Congress. So I have spent more than a decade up there in those buildings. They are working buildings. They have their own kind of rhythms. And, you know, I've bought lunch from the same cafeteria worker for years and years on end, right? I mean, these are places where there are real people. For me, it was like my workplace was attacked in addition to all of the ramifications that there are around democracy and other things.
And not just any workplace. Having worked in the Hill, I remember walking around and really feeling a kind of awe.
Yeah.
Right? Of like the statues and the paintings and watching debates and really feeling like you were in the seat. You were a fly on the wall in one of the most esteemed and hallowed spaces where representative democracy has been working.
Right. Has been.
Has yeah. been.
Now, whenever I walk through the Capitol Rotunda, I always remind myself to look up.
Yeah.
You know, it's easy to just keep going instead of looking up at the dome. But it's just stunningly beautiful. And it really says so much about all those things that you just outlined. So, yeah, I mean, so that day was.
And pride. That's the word I'm missing. I felt pride and I felt like an American.
Patriotism, right? It's supposed to, at its best, represent a system where everyone has a chance to say what they, you know, what they want, what they need, and to hold, to have a little bit of their voice there. And, you know, I think it's served as an accurate and responsive voice, sometimes better than others over the years. It's imperfect. But also I'm not sure there's a more perfect system out there, but it is really being tested right now. And so when I think about that day, and it took me a while to kind of get over the immediate kind of impact of it. And now to see, to watch how people have come around on that, so that Republicans are calling these people January 6 hostages, the people that are being, you know, convicted of crimes in these instances. That is really testing, honestly, the conception I always had of myself as an impartial journalist. And so that's something that I think about a lot when I, you know, sit down every day to try to do this job. And I think that as someone, especially in the national media, which has been very vilified, especially by candidates on the right. I mean, Newt Gingrich started in the 1990s. They'll call it, the phrase they use is Trump derangement syndrome, right?
This is the accusation that reporters and others just spend so much time focusing on Trump and his activities to the detriment of everything and anything else.
Right, that they can't see anything else.
And irrationally so.
And that it's irrational, right. You know, I do think that it's important to, if I'm going to be successful in what I think the ideal is for my job, which is to provide voters with the information that they need to make decisions about who should be elected, like, I need to make sure that they're willing to listen to what I have to say in a way, right? So, you know, I try to think about how is it that I'm presenting this, or what am I doing to talk to voters who support Trump, or who, you know, think that January 6th rioters were there for good reasons. I mean, I think some of them they're just never going to listen to me. It's a lost cause in terms of that. But I do think a lot about that every time I sit down. And I think the central challenge is that a lot of people are tuned out because it feels boring to them. It feels like it's the same. Or they're exhausted, or they see it as conflict driven and they want to just focus on other things in their life. For whatever reason, I mean, you talk to Democrats, people who support the president, they'll say, well, people don't realize it's going to be Trump who's nominated, right? They just don't know that. They can't imagine that he could possibly be nominated again or possibly be president again. And the thing that is true about this is that, one, it's a race that feels like one we've covered before in 2020, a race that already happened, a race that's going to be the same for 8 months. But it also is a race that has stakes that are higher than probably any presidential campaign I have ever covered.
Because why?
Because if Donald Trump gets reelected, I think the chances that the guardrails that hold kind of the norms of our system together are stripped away is very high.
So you don't look at all these court cases, which I'm not a person who thinks he necessarily needs to be convicted or something like that in order for there to be some kind of justice. But I do look at the judiciary as actually shoring up those guardrails, building case law that says yes to this, no to that, in areas that we didn't think needed shoring up until Trump.
Didn't occur to us.
I know.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see what happens with the legal system, but there's so far the strategy of delaying what's going on has been an effective one.
The Trump strategy.
And if they do delay these cases past the election and he gets reelected, he's going to have a lot of control over whether or not they go forward. So, and I don't say that to make people think that I am coming down on this in one way or the other. I just am trying to say that I think the stakes for the future of our system are higher than they have probably ever been, certainly in the time that I've been covering this. I mean, I should amend my statement. Obviously, during the Civil War, the country was grappling with something much more significant. And there also was more, you know, there were high levels of political violence in the 60s around some of these things. But this,
where a lot was at stake for large numbers of the population.
For massive numbers of people, yes. And I don't want to lose sight of that. But I do think there is a real question of what, if Trump is elected again, what a second Trump term looks like, especially considering his affinity for autocracy, some of the things, some of the policy positions and proposals that have been put out there from the people coming in. I just think that there are a lot of Americans who don't actually think it's plausible that any of that could happen. And I think if I learned anything,
because they've been through a Trump administration, which, while chaotic, et cetera, the sky didn't fall, so to speak.
It depends on how you look at it. I think for me, I covered the entire Trump administration from Capitol Hill after I covered the 2016 campaign. And the thing that I heard over and over and over again from Republican members of Congress, of whom I had very strong professional relationships with, many of them, before Trump. Most of those people that I had those kinds of relationships with are now gone. They didn't want to stick around in Washington. But they would say to me, you know, and they had one thing to say in public and one thing to say in private. And every day I went on TV, I was asked, well, when are these people going to say something about what's going on? And the answer is always like, well, I know that in private they think this is insane. And basically they kept telling me, it's going to be fine. You're freaking out about nothing. The guardrails are going to hold. The system's going to hold. And then we all looked up on January 6th. And, you know, there's blood smeared on the statues and windows broken and, you know, hang Mike Pence being chanted and people are in the hallways hunting for Nancy Pelosi to do Lord knows what. I mean, I spent 4 years. It was like a frog in a boiling water situation for these Republicans, right? They're like, every little thing, they're like, oh, they got to write it off. They got to write it off. It's not a big deal. It's not a big deal. It's all going to be fine. It's all going to hold. And then on that day, it was very clear that actually this guy was going to do the maximum possible to actually remain president of the United States. So I think that you're right, that there are a lot of people who experienced the Trump administration and sort of thought, well, at the end of the day, my life was fine. But that was not my experience, right, in terms of what happened to the place that I sort of called my working home for a long time. And I think I learned from that. And I don't think that anything is going to be off the table. I don't really know what that anything is.
Yeah.
I just know that the stakes are very high.
So the next big kind of pivotal moment would be the State of the Union, which is happening also this week. And what's the point, do you think, of this kind of speech in this day and age, in this media environment, right?
Well, in this media environment, the point is that you actually can get a wide swath of people to pay attention to the same thing at the same time. That said, I think that it's a much diminished platform, and I think it's almost a situation where you have more risk, especially if you're President Biden, than anything else, because all everybody's going to be watching for on Thursday is whether he can get through it without having a senior moment. I mean, that's just how it's going to be watched. It's how it's going to be viewed.
And just about any stumble can and will be interpreted as a senior moment.
Exactly. Fair or unfair. I mean, there are plenty of younger presidents who've had bad moments at, you know, a State of the Union address, but that's kind of what the American public is seeing right now from President Biden. So I think more than even it usually is, it is a performance situation. I do think, you know, he had, I was talking to Kate Bedingfield, who was Biden's longtime communications director in the White House. Now she's here with CNN. But she pointed out that he had some strong moments in last year's speech where there was interaction with the audience that left
members
of Congress.
You're saying interaction with the audience. This is a euphemism for Republicans yelling at him and him, you know, wisecracking back.
Right. Handling it in an effective way, or a way that like kind of made him come across as though he had won that particular back and forth or that particular interaction.
And I recall sort of boxing them into some kind of policy issue. It was on Social Security.
Yes.
It sort of made it seem like they were going after Social Security. And he played off of that and was quick on his feet in doing it.
He was. Yeah. And Biden at his best. I mean, that was very much, I've actually covered Joe Biden for a lot of years. I mean, I remember there's a little kind of antechamber outside of the Senate floor. And I remember, you know, and he was kind of a gregarious figure to cover. He like put both of his hands on both of my shoulders. He's a tall guy. I'm a tall person, too, but he's very tall. Like he kind of looks down at me and he goes, Casey, you know, what do you got for me today? And it was something, you know, he was on the foreign policy, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee at the time. That sort of very natural politician, you know, very tactile politician is in there, right? And you don't get as far as he's gotten without having those kinds of instincts that would lead him to have that kind of a moment at the State of the Union. But I think what we're seeing in the polling is that voters are looking at him and seeing a diminished version of that. And I think that's the central challenge for the State of the Union. I mean, it's kind of unfortunate, but that's kind of where we are.
Well, Casey, thank you so much for coming and chatting with me.
I know you'll be back. I'm so grateful you asked me.
Casey Hunt is the host of CNN This Morning. Tune in from 5 to 7 a.m. Eastern. You can also subscribe to that show's audio podcast. We got you. We'll have a link to that in our show notes. The Assignment is a production of CNN Audio. This episode was produced by Dan Bloom. Our senior producer is Matt Martinez. Dan DeZula is our technical director, and Steve Lichtai is the executive producer of CNN Audio. We got support from Haley Thomas, Alex Manisseri, Robert Mathers, John Dianora, Lenny Steinhardt, Jameis Andrus, Nicole Pesaru, and Lisa Namorow. Thanks, as always, to Katie Hinman. I'm Audie Cornish. Thank you for listening.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.